hour number two. Bible Study Hour, Ask the Pastor. I'm Chuck Rathick. Our numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And our guest today is Dr. Victor Raj. He is professor at Concordia Seminary here in Clayton. He made the 150-yard trip down the road here to our studio. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning to you, Chuck. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you.
You tired of winter yet?
Not yet. I have no choice. I'm just in the middle of it.
You're from India. Do they have winter in India?
I had to go like 2,000 miles away from where I was raised to see the first winter.
I should know better. I don't know where India is in relationship to the equator. I don't know if it's a largely warm country most of the time.
It is largely warm country. It's literally, my home is literally 6 degrees north of the equator. India.
So that's like tropics.
It is tropics. It is summer and summer in Western terms. It's India has one standard time, Indian standard time, and there are no time zones. That means the sun is there 11 and a half hours to almost 13 and a half hours a day.
So have you come to form a deep appreciation of 10-degree weather and snow plows and things like that?
You mean Celsius or Fahrenheit?
Fahrenheit.
Yeah. India still uses Celsius, so it's a little bit more tolerant when you do the Celsius.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, but the word...
not 10 above in Celsius is not too bad at all.
It's not too bad at all. It's comfortable weather. What is this now? So the change of seasons is something that I do appreciate, especially as I live in the U.S. for all these years. But what you miss, I shouldn't say this, but what you miss is sun in the United States when you actually want it. There's no missing of sun back home where I was raised. That's the fundamental difference. And I grew up in sweat. I mean that literally.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about humidity. And I didn't know what it was, but I got used to it for the first 25 years of my life. Now I know what humidity is, theoretically and also experientially. So it's different.
Well, take a look out the window there, because the sun's shining now. It's probably going to go away in the next 5 minutes. But
My office is 2 minutes away, but by walk. Today I drove. So You get to see my perspective on life these days.
So are you teaching this term at Concordia Seminary? What are you teaching?
I am teaching theology of mission. I have two sections of that. I got done with one. Then as I return by 12:30, I will be doing the second session.
Theology of mission.
Correct.
Mission meaning going out and telling the world about Jesus?
No, this is a struggle in any language. You got to do the broad meaning and narrow meaning and all of the above. Chuck, you said we'll be talking about something else. Now we get into mission. Shall we talk?
Well,
even then,
I've got my little thing all ready to go here.
Yeah, there is mission and evangelism.
But I'm always interested in what you're teaching.
Very much so. And what we are doing in our class is we have as good stewardship of time and stuff and substance. We have three parts to it. One, we do the transforming nature of mission, if you will. That's fundamentally dealing with culture, people, religions, and so on. We only have 30 hours during the quarter, the first 10 hours, approximately that much. We spend on understanding, at least trying to get a handle on how people think and behave these days.
Seems to me that the course on theology of mission would be about a 10-minute thing there. Go ye therefore into all the world, teach all nations, and baptizing them, etc.
Yeah.
And then you're pretty much done, aren't you?
We are pretty much done. And
Write
a paper and turn it in. And Chuck, you're good. I like you.
It's
10 minutes, and it's Matthew 28, to be precise, and go make disciples of all nations, to put myself on the spot. You go, I'm staying.
But there's a problem.
Yeah.
Because in the current age in which you are preparing men to be pastors, going forth to all nations and teaching them the truth about God and baptizing them into the kingdom can be perceived as a largely intolerant act on the part of a lot of people these days.
Correct.
Who are you to say that you have the truth? Particularly, for example, if you were in India and you had a lot of Hindu brothers around, who are you to tell them, well, you know, your belief is wrong. I have the correct belief. Isn't that intolerant? And then to suggest to them that they need to come and join your group, well, that's as intolerant as the day is long. So it's a bit of a different challenge these days, the theology of mission, is it not?
It is. So is the Christian faith altogether. Truth is not limited to situations where we are confronting. I say confronting people of other faiths and persuasions. Truth is an issue that lurks all over the place, in the classroom, within the household, as we deal with people of other cultures, as we deal with our people in the neighborhood who may also share the same culture with us. So truth is manifold. The issue is also manifold. So I'd rather not speak about truth, because everything I speak here is truth and nothing but the truth. The difficulty there is, I think if we even apologetically begin to broach the topic of truth, we may not be accomplishing what the Lord would have us accomplish in our own humble way. Let's talk about Jesus Christ, and mission of God. Mission is the heart of God, according to the Christian, especially the Lutheran way of understanding. God's heart goes out for people. God desires, this is 1 Timothy, God desires all people to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. At least for argument's sake, I'll say God desires all people to be saved and then come to the knowledge of the truth. So truth is not the priority. Well, granted that Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and life, and I need to look at that carefully, especially in today's context. If I insist on, which I rightly do, and confidently do, that Jesus is the truth, that is not the truth people are looking for these days. That is why. First of all, they don't acknowledge the truth of Jesus. Secondly, the truth they are looking for is abstract. Therefore, they could say, on the one hand, truth is relative. You have hung on to something through tradition, through family, through church, etc. What else can you do? On the other hand, when they broach the topic that way, they are not really dealing with the question of truth. They are finding a way to defend themselves and cover up the fundamental question they may be dealing with. And that's difficult. That's too much for me to speak about in this limited time, and too much for us to even begin to comprehend. But look up the scriptures, look up the... I'm visualizing in my mind images I have seen of the different names of Jesus. My son actually has a drawing where he has the image of Jesus printed onto it or imposed onto it. Different names of Jesus. Lamb of God, Good Shepherd, the Way, the Truth, and Life. And you name it. There are more than 100 names that you could, appellations, descriptions of Jesus Christ. And let's get to that. So fundamentally, what I'm saying here is, when we discuss truth, and especially in the context of the mission and the theology of mission, we are pouring the heart of God out to people who desires all people to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. Fundamentally, we are preaching Christ in Lutheran terms and biblical terms, Christ and Him crucified. Let's talk about Him instead of the abstracts. You want to go to the abstracts? Jesus is not only the truth, but He is the wisdom of God.
When you teach the theology of mission, I'm going to guess that there is not a one-size-fits-all glove that you can sort of deliver to your students. If one of your students were to make the trip to India, India has Hindus.
Correct.
Buddhists.
Yes.
Islam.
Yes.
Christians are in the minority.
Correct.
The theology of mission, seems to me, would be played out in a different way than if you were to go to Haiti, for example, where it's my understanding here since Haiti's been in the news, that the predominant religious setting there is some kind of a combination of Roman Catholicism and voodoo. A lot of people in Haiti, I don't know what to call it, voodoo Catholics? I don't know what we would call it. You can't take the same theology of mission into Haiti that you would take to India. Or then here in the United States, for example, and this is kind of where I'm headed here, where Oprah Winfrey has been described by some as the high priestess of civil religion. Now, when a person comes out of your class, are they going to be ready to go to any one of these places and use the same formula in each? Or is each context change the question?
To put your question in perspective, which I am comprehending and continuing to comprehend, I will use the sociological, psychological, or socio-psychological term these days, which is becoming dominant in critical thinking, which you probably can recognize as quickly, which calls itself fuzzy logic.
Fuzzy
logic. And as a Bible student and as an exegete, I'm looking at the two words specifically and trying to see the symbiosis.
Yeah?
Yeah, fuzzy and logical. Fuzziness does not, by its appearance, embrace logic. It's more than the gray area in the black and white categories or images and stuff. And that fuzziness continues to be, it has very positive things. That's actually, our life is fuzzy, not in the complicated or confusing sense of it, but in the clear sense of it, trying to begin to make sense out of what's already complicated and sophisticated and beyond human comprehension. But we live as intelligent human beings in this fuzzy culture. Being fuzzy is probably the best of situations that we have today, given the plethora of spiritualities, lifestyles, perspectives, you name them. And in that context, as we go to the question here, I am reminded of the Lutheran position, particularly the Lutheran position of the scandal of particularity, meaning God wants all people to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth in God's own way. It is in God's own way that we are convicted as sinners. It is in God's own way that we are found wanting in His eyes. And if that's the predicament in which human beings are, it has to be God's own way by which anyone can be reconciled, saved, brought to the knowledge of the truth. There is no other way.
The story I have today is headlined, Christian Apologists, then there's a colon, meaning this is what the Christian apologists are saying, Be Careful of Oprah's Spiritual Teachings. This story comes out of Vienna, Virginia. It says she is persuasive, influential, and does a lot of good. But Christians should be careful when Oprah speaks about spirituality. That's a warning coming from two apologists who recently co-authored a book on the subject. To a crowd of more than 1,500 people at McLean Bible Church outside of Washington, D.C., last Friday evening, renowned apologist Josh McDowell and up-and-coming apologist Dave Sterrett explained the danger of adopting Oprah's spiritual teachings from a Christian perspective. They pointed out that the talk show Queen and the spiritual teachers she promotes teach pantheism. God is all, and all is God. And that there are multiple paths to reach God. She also emphasizes that people should carry out their inner longings instead of restraining themselves if the act is said to be a sin by the Bible. McDowell emphasized, quote, Here is where you got to be careful. Not only Oprah, but others use Christian or religious terminologies that Christians would accept as Christian, unquote. The Christian God is a personal creator God in which all truth resides, who is totally outside of ourselves and outside of our universe. When Oprah and others refer to God, it is an impersonal force. And I think one way that comes out is that they will say, look within you and find yourself from within. Find that God consciousness. That is God. That's what Josh McDowell had to say. And how do you react to these claims?
I have many, many reactions to them because this is a long narrative. I'm going to give another narrative from human experience, if I may use that expression. I do occasionally, at least I used to watch religious television channels. One of them I recall is a Roman Catholic channel, and I'm not church bashing, where they repeatedly bringing former Lutherans, former Baptists, former Pentecostals, former some other non-Catholic and now converted to religion and gotten to know the truth as it is enunciated, explicated by the church. Less than a week ago, in a grocery store, I ran across a woman who, for some reason, stopped me and spoke with me and said, I used to be a Catholic. Now, I believe in Jesus. The first time ever I had that confession brought to me without me inviting somebody in to my ears. So you can be religious, including a Catholic or any other congregation, Christian congregation, and have all the pomp and circumstances and not know Jesus. She said she was raised Catholic. Her home, her family has a tradition of hundreds of years of Catholicism, as much as she can recall. But now she found Jesus. I would not say to what religion, quote unquote. She is now a member, but she now knows Jesus and she now believes. Now, the Oprah Winfrey situation, George McDonald. The situation there is bad. If I had my PowerPoints up, I would have 3 eggs. Actually, I made that speech recently in the class. I call them eggs to be hatched. The egg in the middle, which I have put it vertically, is the church. And I'm speaking particularly of the Western culture. That egg is, I'm not talking denomination here, of which I'm a member, and you're a member, and all believing Christians are members, trans-denominationally, okay, particularly in the American context. Okay, people actually are members, and they show that in their actions, in their behaviors, in their patterns of worship, etc., etc. Then, on a side, there is an equally big egg on one side, which is somewhat closely connected with the church. And speaking in the American context, I'm talking about Christians, nominal, Christians raised in Christian tradition, Christians, some of them even baptized, but they may not be coming to congregate on a weekend basis. They would send, they would still send their contributions practically to get a tax deduction. They would send their children to Christian schools, even for a fee, because that's where they get their best education, and so on and on. They are not completely cut off from their church, but nor are they actively Christians in a community, even in a community sense. And I cannot, they may have a Christian vocabulary in their psyche because much of Western culture is loaded with biblical language. So it may be coming sociologically, psychologically from their mouth, but in their heart, is their heart connected with the heart of God who desires all people to be saved in and through Jesus Christ alone? I have questions about it. Those are the two eggs. And then there's a much larger egg on the right-hand side of the diagram here. And that is peripherally related to the big egg, the central egg, which I call the church. This egg is big, yet to be hatched. And the content of that egg is very symbolic of what's happening in the United States these days and happening all over the mission field throughout the world. They connect with the church for social, psychological, moral reasons. They even send their children to Christian schools, especially if the education is free. They even call their pastor, the local Christian pastor, even to go to their non-Christian home and bless it. They will be reading Christian literature. They will be benefiting from the Christian hospitals and medical services that the Christians render. They might even come to church occasionally, but still they will also go to the Hindu temple, the mosque, and elsewhere. So that's the other category. And what Oprah Winfrey talks about in terms of spirituality is all of the above. She will have to continue to use Christian spirituality.
She put all her eggs in one basket?
Yeah. Thank you. And she would not know any spiritual language other than Christian language as much as she knows. She can, at least when she comes to the, I don't know what's actually going on in her heart as a person, when she comes to the public and puts a public face up there, she is, in theological terms, a pluralist, an inclusivist, and all of the above. She has spiritualities of all kinds. I don't know if she speaks God language. She speaks spiritual language. And what's the closest you can come, humanly speaking, when you speak spirituality? That is God, an expression that she avoids. And if she does that, she consciously, perhaps, avoids Jesus Christ or the Trinitarian God. That's the difference.
This could be a glass half full or a glass half empty situation. We could look at it as half full and say, well, you know, Oprah has this tremendous audience of people who watch her, who follow her, buy her books and follow her recommendations. And she could be strictly a secularist and religion and spirituality could never come onto the scene. But it's a good thing that she talks about these things and brings this into the debate. That way people have a sensitivity, they have an awareness. It may not be perfect, but at least it's not completely excluded. Or we could have a glass half empty view and say, I wish she'd never talk about spiritual things at all. All she does is damage. All she does by raising these questions is make it worse. Are you a half full or a half empty guy?
I'm a two-thirds empty and one-third full guy. Because you put me on the spot, I'm putting you on the spot.
All right.
I don't know which one is full and which one is empty. Full, if that is the way to deal with the empty or the full part of it. because her baggage, I'm putting her on the spot now, okay? Or anybody who fills her shoes, any situation, who is, in my opinion, a pluralist and somebody who is accommodating, who is dealing with spirituality and not theology. Oprah has not been trained as a theologian, not by going to school, not even self-taught. So I do not give that appellation to her so easily. Fundamentally, she is, in my jargon, which is commonplace in many circles, she is a need-based evangelist. Evangelism is a good word. I shouldn't be using that, but I did that. She is a need-based motivation speaker who uses experiential knowledge and couples that with religion and spirituality and makes a convincing case. I said experiential. Not only does she speak to the heart, psychologically, morally, etc., but she also brings in people who have these felt needs met in some miraculous fashion through her encounter and listening to her. And so she's an experiential speaker with a lot of experience to herself, to her credit. So what she's doing is, on the one hand, this is the other one-third of it. On the one hand, she uses Christian expressions because she would not know Hindu or Muslim, Islamic or Buddhist expressions to even speak religion. On the other hand, she fills in all those expressions. She loads them up with non-biblical, non-Christian themes and concepts.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be right back in the Bible study. In the book of Philippians, Paul connects the Philippians' generosity to Old Testament sacrificial giving and fragrant offering. On the Bible study, I asked Pastor Kurt Taylor to make that connection for me.
If somebody were to look at this from a purely human perspective, all they're going to see is that there are some people in Philippi who are sending money to this guy in Rome. But what Paul is doing is he's lifting this up to another level, that by your supporting my ministry, you are making an offering to God. Because what I'm doing is going out with the Word of God, and you're enabling me to do that, again, from a human level with money and with gifts. And when Paul then says that by doing that, you're offering a fragrant offering and acceptable sacrifice to God, we're seeing how Paul is so closely connecting God and his church.
Study the Bible with us weekday mornings at 10:05.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
Israel's two chief rabbis are stepping up their campaign against abortion. They recently sent a letter to many other rabbis which says legal abortion is delaying the coming of the Messiah. Of course, you and I know Jesus has already arrived and completed his task for the sinful world. But in Israel, those of the Jewish faith are still waiting. The chief rabbis say abortion is an epidemic that's costing thousands of Jewish souls each year, with 500,000 killed to date. This point of view comes from a passage in the Talmud which says redemption won't happen until all the souls are brought out of their storing place. And they believe abortion is seriously delaying this from happening. Maybe this ongoing effort is working. The number of abortions in Israel is declining.
Life Issues. Stay informed. More informed than you've ever been.
Riveting testimony. I'm Norman Hall with Religion Roundup. Jurors in Wichita, Kansas have heard from witnesses to the church slaying of abortion provider Dr. George Tiller. Scott Roeder has publicly admitted gunning down Dr. Tiller last May at a Wichita church. Tiller was an usher at the church. Two ushers told jurors what they saw.
On cross-examination, one of the things the defense attorneys were able to bring out was that apparently also Roeder said, "Lord, forgive me."
But one of the ushers also testified that Roeder threatened to shoot him if he followed. Roeder has said in court documents that he was attempting to protect the unborn. The court hasn't ruled out allowing jurors to consider a lesser charge. And a new faith group, the New Evangelical Partnership for the Common Good, is calling on international lenders to forgive Haiti of its foreign debt. The group says Haiti should instead invest its capital in long-term projects to help its residents recover from the earthquake. With Religion Roundup, I'm Norman Hall.
Every hour throughout the day at KFUO Radio, we let you know about events you're being invited to at churches all around the St. Louis area. We're blessed with active congregations who are giving us opportunities for fellowship in various ways. If you're having a sausage supper or a friendship Sunday, please let us know about it. We'll place your announcement in rotation with others that we've received to be mentioned throughout the day. Send word of your event to dsummers@kfuo.org. And thanks.
The men and women of the Missouri Bar live and work in our community. They're our friends and neighbors, trusted advisors we count on when we need legal assistance. They are professionals serving on volunteer boards and community organizations, coaching Little League, mentoring at-risk youth, helping feed the hungry, working with senior citizens, improving life in our community. This message brought to you by the men and women of the Missouri Bar. Learn more at MissouriBar.org.
You're listening to our Ask the Pastor Hour of the Bible Study. I'm Chuck Rathert. Dr. Victor Raj is with us today. He is professor at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Our numbers are 505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. Herman is on the line. Hi, Herman. You're on the Bible Study. Good morning. Go right ahead with your question. Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, I'm sorry, Herman. I forgot to push the button here. Now you're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes,
yes, I'd like to ask Dr. Raj, when he was on last year, he mentioned a review of the historical account of the Apostle Thomas's martyrdom and the establishment of what is now known as the Church of South India. Would Dr. Raj agree with this position that there is enough evidence from Scripture and the history of the Church of South India and Thomas's role in it that he proclaimed and taught an orthodox creedal basic New Testament Christianity, and that the neo-Gnostic scholars today, like Elaine Pagels, who try to bring out and promote this Gospel of Thomas, that the evidence about Thomas himself historically, both in Scripture and in the account of the Church of South India, shows that he could not be construed as being a New Age Gnostic, as these that later Gospel of Thomas was after his lifetime anyway.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Herman, thank
you. Are you up to speed on that question?
I am. I don't know what level, 60 miles, 200 miles, I can go all over the place. Thanks, Herman, anyway, for the question. It's loaded, and I want to dissect the question first, at least in a minimal way. First of all, the Church of South India is not a St. Thomas Church, nor does it claim St. Thomas tradition. So Church of South India was formed in 1948. In 1947, India became independent from the British colonization. In 1948, the first ever in the history of Christendom throughout the world, several of these former mission agencies that worked in India came together and formed a Church of South India, which, as I said earlier, has very little to do with St. Thomas, because these mission agencies came in the 16th century, particularly in the 18th century, since the British invasion. There were Baptists, Anabaptists, Basel Mission, the Church of England, Presbyterians, and you name them. They all came together and formed the Church of South India, and in 1971, a similar body was formed in the northern part of India called the Church of North India. St. Thomas Christians, however, are, to quote somebody from the St. Thomas tradition who wrote a book like 15 years ago, not, St. Thomas Christians are born, not begotten. Not begotten is my attachment to that not born claim. St. Thomas Christians are born, according to the St. Thomas Christians. There are close to 10 million of them. I come from the southern part of India. If you look at the map, at the southwest corner, that's as south as you can go, from a state called Kerala. And I'm at the southern tip of that state, and about 90 miles north of my home where I grew up is the first touchdown of St. Thomas. And remember this, I wish we could see each other face to face. Remember this, this is the tradition. This is the tradition, I insist. When I was a SEM student 35 years ago, we had read several books on this, and there were 25 reasons for St. Thomas to have literally come to India by boat and then go on by feet and get killed, etc. And there were also 25 reasons for him not to have come. So this is at the seminary and other places, you do this academic exercise. But recently, I mean in the last 20, 30 years plus, even several of the European scholars are allowing the possibility, if not at least, the possibility of St. Thomas having come. In the latest book I saw 5 years ago on this issue was prefaced by a scholar who is by faith Hindu. And he is unable to argue convincingly against this whole argument that St. Thomas had come. Be as it may, from the second and into the early part of the third century of our era, the Christian era, there are archaeological, historically undeniable arguments, evidences in favor of the Christian presence in that part of the world. So that is significant enough. And then as we go into detailing the whole story, there may have been if you're a theologian, we talk about in the academic circles, St. Paul and the Pauline school. You could make a case for the St. Thomas school, as it were. If not himself, or a disciple of him could have come, and so on. These are all arguments back and forth. Tradition. I mean, you had several facets to your question. They are all significant and very important to discuss and deal with. The evidence, and then when we go past Shakespeare, beyond Shakespeare, even Shakespeare's historicity is questioned by people, as you know. So once you go beyond that, you got to allow a lot of room for tradition to establish your historicity. So about 20 miles south of where I was raised, there is a church of St. Thomas. The tradition is that St. Thomas came to that part of the world we call Kerala, the southern west state, most southern west state of India. And he established within a 120-mile range seven churches. And now we call it seven and a half church. And that's actually the eighth church. This church is literally 20 miles south of where I was raised. So these traditions go on. And the tradition is, if you look up the map of India, he would then finally go to what we now know as the city of Madras. Now it's called Chennai, which is now 8+ million people. There is a St. Thomas Mount where he was apparently killed, which is still alive, and a touristy place. There's, of course, the Catholic Church and the school and the monasteries and what kinds. And there's also a St. Thomas Church, which is, I would call, the Second Vatican, if you know what I'm talking about. Center, the hub of Christianity, especially Roman Catholic Christianity in India. So all these evidences are so clear. The question you had, Herman, this is an exciting question. This is loaded. This is more than a thesis that you posited here. What has that to do with the Gnostic Gospels? The Thomas Gospel of Thomas, with the Gnostics claim, and the New Age folks claim as the foundation for their building a bridge between New Age spirituality and the Bible and so on. Sorry, I don't have a very civilized expression on it. That has no historic, not to speak of theological foundation. New Age is New Age. Gnosticism is Gnosticism. And that has very little to do with biblical Christianity, and I submit even the Christianity St. Thomas preached. This is what I call, well, as we could easily acknowledge, accommodating something, everyone, to find some kind of a common ground, another modern expression. And everybody, I mean, I do apologize again, with no apology necessary here. You could dig out Bible verses to claim that a person must be immersed to be fully baptized. You could do that. But you're actually doing a lot of hard work, because you all are already opinionated and you're looking for a proof text. And this is another embellished form of that attempt to mix Gnosticism into the pure grace God lavishes upon human beings on account of Jesus Christ. And I didn't exhaust all the answers, but at least that's how I'm looking at the whole story here, Herman. Thank you.
Wow. If I'd have been taking notes, I probably could have written a paper and passed your next class.
It's more than a paper.
It's more than a paper.
And much has been written on it.
I have another question for you here. And I can't remember if I raised this issue with you the last time you were here or not.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking I did not, but if I did, just let me know. There is quite a debate going on in the country of Malaysia,
mm-hmm,
about the use of the word Allah by Christians when referring to God. Did we talk about that last time you were here?
I don't know, but I am aware of that struggle, especially where the culture is dominated with a certain religion, and then you are getting in there as a new missionary, or Christianity comes in as a new religion, and what do you do with that?
Well, yes. Here's the story from Time magazine. I just read a little bit of it here,
mm-hmm,
just to get it out on the table for our, mm-hmm, listener. Why are the Christians claiming Allah? Asks businessman Rahim Ismail, 47 years old, his face contorted in rage and disbelief. He shakes his head and raises his voice while waiting for a taxi along Jalan Tun Razak, a main thoroughfare in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia's capital. Everybody in the world knows Allah is the Muslim God and belongs to Muslims. I cannot understand why the Christians want to claim Allah as their God, Rahim says, as passers-by, mostly Muslims, gather around and nod in agreement. The reason for their anger is a recent judgment by Malaysia's High Court that the word Allah is not exclusive to Muslims. Judge Lau B. Lan ruled that others, including Catholics who had been prohibited by the Home Ministry from using the word in their publications since 2007, can now use the term. She also rescinded the prohibition order that forbade the Malay language edition of the Catholic Monthly, which is titled The Herald, to use Allah to denote the Christian God. After widespread protests, however, the judge granted a stay order on January 7th. The same day, the government appealed to the higher court of appeal to overturn the ruling. Now, as a man from India, I don't know if it's appropriate to assume that Malaysia is in the neck of the woods over there. It is a large Islamic population. Are you able to explain this to me or familiarize me with the situation there and why this is such an enormous question there? It's a question for me as an American Christian. I'm thinking, well, of course you don't, as Christians in Malaysia, use Allah as your term for God. But they do. And is it okay from a cultural standpoint, from your perspective, or how do you see it?
I'm thinking because I am used to, and I was trained in, and I am convinced of the either or. Lately, in my culture, we also have intentionally begun to use the word yes to a question. So I talked about the fuzzy logic.
Right.
And here we are dealing with Allah. Is it a cultural term? Is it a linguistic thing? Is it religious? Is it not loaded with religiosity and history of religions and spirituality and theological impregnation, etc., etc.? These are questions that come to mind. This is, again, where I believe the fuzzy logic principle operates strongly. One of the challenges of postmodernism, of which I know very little, I am living it experientially, is from my reading I understand that for the postmodern mind, meaning emerges. Meaning emerges. Our kids were used to saying, what is true to you need not be true to me. But when the President of the United States makes a statement, the Secretary of State or his personal secretary comes up and says, when President said this, what he really meant was, well, you didn't hear it the way he meant it because you always oppose him, etc., etc. So you see how meaning emerges.
Mm-hmm.
And the question here is, Allah, is it a theological word or is it not a word in the Arabic language? I'm not talking Muslim. In the Arabic language that signifies God. It is difficult. Allah is not Yahweh. Allah is not Jesus. Yahweh is God. So in my reading, Yahweh is Allah. I'm trying to see a distinction, at least to make sense out of the struggle here. That's what I'm doing. Jesus is Allah. A Muslim will kill me for that.
A Muslim will kill you for
kill
that.
Kill me for that.
The story says here that because of this controversy, three churches were firebombed.
Correct.
So and apparently killing is in the...
In the works.
In the works.
In the books. And it's in real life. I will, not to get off of the topic, I mentioned my home state being Kerala, where we speak a language. We are 39 million of us, and if all the immigrants like me went back, it would be like 46 million. We got 7 million people who speak my language who are scattered all over to 162 countries of the world, and we have 2.5 million of them in the United States. Okay, my neighboring state speaks Tamil, which is 90 million. This is not Muslim. In the Tamil language, they have two different words for God used in the Holy Bible. Two different words. One is the Roman Catholic version, and the other one is the Protestant version. They have taken exception to, even in the newer translation, they still hold on to that position. They have taken words from the culture, the Tamil culture, and translated Yahweh into that language. And they for that translation of one specific Hebrew word, these two traditions picked two different words. The argument there is perhaps one according to this other tradition believes that this particular word has a greater experiential Hindu nuance than the other. So that's why I said this is fuzzy logic. And you come to the Islamic culture, not Islam, the person who embraces, a person who lives in the Islamic culture, for that person, let's say, I'm sorry, Oprah is not here, an Oprah Winfrey who lives in the Islamic culture, for that person, Allah would be the God, word for God.
The story says, because of Malaysia's ethnic makeup, religion is a sensitive issue, as we've demonstrated.
Malaysia is dominated by Muslims. I don't know the numbers, but it's up in the 90%.
Well, it says here, some 60% of Malaysia's 28 million people are Malay Muslim.
Correct.
The rest are mainly ethnic Chinese, Indians,
which is why I brought this up to you,
or members of indigenous tribes practicing various faiths, including Buddhism, Christianity, Hinduism, and animism. Among Christians, the majority Catholics number about 650,000, or 3% of the population. So we have a melting pot here.
Correct.
And a variety of languages, a variety of words as it pertains to Yahweh, Allah, God with a big G, God with a little G, on and on.
Yes.
And at some point, I think somebody listening to this conversation might say, what a mess, what a tangled mess. Why are we even talking about this? Why, you know, you're not going to sort it out. And we probably wouldn't be talking about it, except that people are going to die because of this conflict. And as I pointed out, the man who is quoted in this story, who is a taxi cab driver, is enraged. He's not just put out, he's enraged. Somebody in his company, somebody who believes like he believes, may at some point kill one of these Catholics or one of these Christians over there because they dare to use the word Allah when they are referring to Yahweh. That's what you pointed out. You could be killed if you were to do that. So it's not something that we can just say, oh, you know, it's a mess. Can't sort it out. We can't do that because people are going to die. So, Dr. Raj, from your perspective, a man who grew up in India and has experienced far more different languages and cultures than I will ever experience in the rest of my life, what do we do with this problem?
Silence. I would look at this issue, as I have, in many different dimensions. First of all, you got to have a language. The goal of a missionary, the goal of a person who believes his faith to be true, I'm putting it so generic terms, is to convince another that his faith is true. To do so, one needs to communicate that faith to the other. And for that, you need a medium, which we call language. We don't have the time, but I mentioned this here on another occasion. About 6 months ago, I had this experience in South County, where I live, quote-unquote. A lady and I started a conversation, and then she asked me, Do you speak English? Do you speak English? And the point, the joke, it became humorous because I took it lightly. She didn't. She couldn't think that I would speak it.
Mm-hmm.
And the joke I got out of that is, she's asking me that question in English.
So see, already I'd be just...
Yeah. Yeah, let the lady alone. Leave her alone. and come to the struggle that we have.
Yeah.
Okay? We are... Because that's the language that we know.
Well, let me rephrase the question.
And then you have Allah, which is a common... place word, regardless of the fact that it came from the Arabic, through the Muslims, but it's an Arabic word, which is commonplace, and then you're talking God. What else can you do?
We have about 3 minutes here. Yeah. Let me put the question to you this way.
Yeah.
The Apostle Paul is asked a question about whether or not we should eat meat sacrificed to idols.
Correct.
And he says, well, here's the deal. We know that idols don't exist. Idols mm-hmm. are nothing.
Yes.
So if you eat meat sacrificed to idols, that really is of no consequence. Mm-hmm. However, if my eating meat sacrificed to idols somehow causes my brother to stumble because he sees me, mm-hmm. then I will never eat meat again. So maybe that suggests that the Christians in Malaysia should say, you know what, Muslims, if our using the word Allah for God over here in Malaysia is so infuriating for you, then we'll never use that word again. Maybe that's what they should do. But instead, they've gone to court in order to protect their right to use the word Allah for God, thus equating it with Yahweh and Jesus and inflaming the Muslims. And I'm thinking maybe the Apostle Paul would say, no, don't do that. There's no need to do that. But then, I don't know. In other words, on this occasion, I'm saying maybe it's up to the Christians to find a different way to communicate about the God they believe in.
Yes, they need to communicate the God they believe in a language that the people who do not believe in the God they believe in, i.e. Christians believe in, will be able to comprehend and understand. Well, this is not contextually correct. According to Dr. Martin Luther in his large catechism, whatever you put your trust in is your God. And what are these people putting their trust in? And I'm going to Acts 17. And Paul was preaching in Areopagus, in the Agora, about the unknown God.
You got about 1 minute left.
Unknown God. So the word God is generic in that sense. And unfortunately, in a culture like us, like the Malaysian culture, I don't know the Malaysian language, if Allah is the generic word that the Malaysian culture, I'm not talking Muslims, Malaysian culture uses, I don't have a choice. As difficult and hard as it is, I need to deal with that. But it may be that the Malay language may have a word other than Allah to signify God. Then I can go to Acts 17. And match that word with the unknown God and then begin my conversation. So it's a linguistic as well as a religious question. And maybe this guy is taking it very personally. And like the Christian word God has become commonplace in the Western culture. So perhaps through the Islamic influence in that culture, Allah had become a commonplace word for God. And I cannot say that Christians are doing anything wrong. I cannot say that Muslims have a particular claim on that word in the Malaysian culture. That's the open-ended answer to that question.
Open-ended it shall be. Thank you, Dr. Raj. Good to see you again. Tomorrow we will take up Chapter 10 of the Book of Numbers with Pastor Mark Hawkinson. Our Ask the Pastor guest will be Pastor Kevin Golden from Village Ladue.
Listen to Chuck Rather and guests Monday through Friday at the same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for The Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the Internet at kfuo.org. For a free copy of The Bible Study, please visit the audio archive section of our homepage. That's kfuo.org. The Bible Study is a broadcast service of Worldwide KFUO.